Could you explain the relevant areas of Sharia law that involve an element of capital punishment?
Ah, all the best bits.
There is a clear incompatibility. It can't be accommodated as long as we're still part of the European human rights system.
The Sharia law thing, I'm sure people are familiar that there are Jewish courts in the UK. And you never hear the question, why Jewish courts?
Would that not be him not being able to practice, for example, his religious beliefs? Like, where do you draw the line?
From apostates is misunderstood within Islam. It's best translated as treason against the state. That is the better translation. Well, I mean, theoretically, I think in America it's still outlawed treason, and in some places it could be killed. You could be killed for treason against the state. So
doesn't make it right.
Well, I don't think you have a basis to say it's wrong. That's my point. People believe that liberalism as ideology is defined by its tolerance, but by necessity it actually is intolerant, it has to be by its creed, because if something is not liberal according to liberal worldview, that's injustice, and then how can liberalism tolerate injustice? And hence it has to then start to impose itself or deny other systems to exist because they're not liberal.
The Jewish community have been advocating for the needs of their community for well over 2,000 years. We've been living under the rule of other countries for well over 2,000 years.
I guess liberalism has actually taken quite a bashing tonight.
I think you're being a bit harsh on Western society.
I thought I was being gentle.
Oh dear.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Jake. I am the current acting president for ELSA Sussex, which is the European Law Students Association. And I'd like to welcome you all tonight to a discussion on incorporating religious doctrine and practices into a modern human rights culture. First of all, I'd like to introduce from my left Shane Horwell, of co-chairman of the Humanist Society here at Sussex University, that regularly discusses the future of mankind, consequences of experimental science and transhumanism, as well as political current issues as well. Before coming to Sussex, Shane was previously a legal executive specialising in wills and probate with Stoke Solicitors in Portsmouth for about 7 years. Next is Dr. Elizabeth Craig of the Sussex Law School, whose academic interests lie in comparative law and international human rights. She's currently researching, or she could have completed the research, into minority experiences under the Framework Convention for the Protection of National Minorities. Next is Rabbi Zalman of the Chabad Lubavitch in Sussex, that aims to encourage Jewish community spirit between students and young adults in the Brighton and Hove area. And finally is Abdullah Al-Andalusi, who is a member of the Muslim Debate Initiative and a scholar of Sharia law, who has participated in very high-profile debates with the BBC at Big Questions, EDL's Tommy Robinson, and with George Galloway in a TV interview. Okay, and now that out of the way, I'll just like to talk about the agenda for tonight. We will start discussing specific collisions between religious practices and the European Convention on Human Rights, slowly going out to state activity, recent legislation that's been put in place against these sort of religious practices, and eventually coming to a conclusion about the future of human rights in Europe, as well as looking at the ideology behind the European Convention on Human Rights. Okay. And just to start, Abdullah, for the benefit of the audience, could you explain the relevant areas of Sharia law that involve an element of capital punishment?
Ah, all the best bits.
Right. Well, okay. I suppose one of the problems with dealing with the capital law issue in Sharia is people jump straight to that and not look at the kind of conception of human nature, the political philosophy of Sharia and Islamic system, that we don't believe in the understanding that humans are inherently or purely individualistic, but also we are social creatures. We weren't born as individuals, but we came into this world by means of other humans, and most of your personality, most of our kind of characteristics were determined for us, or taught to us, or inculcated in us by our parents and our society. Hence, there is always cultural similarities across different regions, different countries, and so on. So we have a different paradigm when it comes to looking at human beings. We have different values for human actions. So if a human basically does an action which completely does not affect anyone else in any way, shape or form, then generally speaking, the political aspects of Sharia don't interfere in that person's life. So if you want to drink alcohol or engage in same gender intercourse or whatever, or illicit intercourse and so on inside your own house, the political Sharia doesn't interfere. It doesn't concern itself with what you're doing in your own house. But rather, the only aspects that the Sharia concerns itself with is the public square, the public sphere. So if you basically, engage in illicit acts in public, for example, both in terms of, dealing in more commonplace economic problems such as interest, which obviously we prohibit interest, but also dealing in illicit acts in public, that's also prohibited. And even under English law, you can't do illicit acts in public as well. Public indecency laws prevent you from doing the same thing. So what people don't understand is that when it comes to prohibiting illicit acts in the kind of political society, the Sharia and current Western systems actually agree that there are certain things you don't do in public. You know, you will be arrested for that and then prosecuted. But in terms of the private sphere, and strictly the private sphere, the Sharia does not deal with that. Now, I suppose, dealing with the actual capital punishment aspect of the Sharia, why does the Sharia believe in the capital punishment? It's because we believe it's a more humane alternative to locking someone up in a human zoo for the rest of their life, if they commit murder, for example. John Stuart Mill argued as well on his speech against the abolition of capital punishment, that it is more inhumane. It is more inhumane to lock someone up in a cage for the rest of their life, because their suffering is perpetual. You're denying them their freedom, and they are perpetually suffering. Now, if someone committed a murder and you basically executed them for committing murder, then there is obviously an equality of justice. So they committed murder, and hence they are murdered in return, and their suffering ends. So there is no perpetual suffering. And in the Quran, we believe that oppression is worse than killing. So to make someone suffer in their life is worse than actually just killing them. Because when you kill someone, then their suffering ends. It's unjust to kill people, obviously, for unjust causes. But suffering and oppression is worse if you actually think about it. And so John Stuart Mill would agree with the Sharia on that aspect. Now, in terms of just the actual capital punishments themselves, it's all designed as part of a system to be very, quick and obviously as humane as possible, and to produce a deterrent to committing the crime. But what people don't know about is that in the Sharia, we also have a concept of forgiveness. So a victim's family, if you've killed someone in the victim's family, then the victim's family can choose to forgive you, and you'll be let off without no punishment. In obviously liberal penal systems, there is no forgiveness. There can be no forgiveness. You will be punished. It doesn't matter who. No one can forgive you for your crimes, short of probably presidential pardon. But you can't be forgiven, and so you will be punished. And what we see is that from the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and in the Quran, he actually urges believers to actually forgive instead of to punish, because if you actually forgive, then then you deserve God's forgiveness in return. You're more deserving of God's forgiveness. So this Islam both spiritually encourages individuals to actually forgive. So forgive people for killing a member of your family, and forgive them if they've stolen from you, and so on and so forth. So in a nutshell, anyway, that's kind of how Islam views the punishment systems, and because it has an aspect of spiritual values in it, You know, we do have a place for forgiveness as opposed to just sternly punishing, you know, someone no matter what.
Okay, no, good. now, Dr. Elizabeth Craig, I would like to suggest that that perhaps contradicts the European Convention on Human Rights, specifically Protocol 6 in particular, which abolishes outright the death penalty. So with that in mind, what do you feel would be the appropriate method maybe for incorporating this area of Sharia law into Europe, or if it's possible at all?
I mean, I think it's a very good example to discuss first off, because there is a clear incompatibility. I think a lot of the other issues we're likely to discuss, so things like circumcision, things like wearing of religious clothing, it's not always clear what the answer is from an international human rights law perspective in terms of is there, you know, because international human rights law, as most of you know, is very much about balancing of interests. Yes, we have rights, but those rights can be limited in order to protect the rights of others, etc. But clearly, under European human rights law, there is a protocol to the ECHR. It's a protocol that states choose whether or not to sign up to. But I think most Europe, member states have done that.
Apart from Russia, I believe.
Okay. Apart from Russia. And there is a clear prohibition of the death penalty. And so actually, from an international human rights, or from a European human rights law perspective, that issue is actually, there's an incompatibility. And if we look at the situation at global level, you know, a lot of states globally do still have capital punishment. But if we look at it at European level, there is a fundamental incompatibility there, and I don't know how you accommodate it. I don't think you can. It's international human rights law works on the basis of state consent. States accede to or ratify international human rights treaties, and if they ratify a treaty that prohibits the death penalty as a matter of international law, that's the situation that should apply.
I see. So would you suggest that maybe that there should be like an open dialogue into perhaps giving some leeway, a bit more of a push towards maybe social libertarianism in a way that allows Muslims that practice Sharia law to be a part of this separate legal system for their personal discourses? Would you say that would be accepted in an international, in a European sphere?
I think the issue you're raising is a much more general issue, because obviously Sharia law, you know, there has lots of implications for regulation of family life, and all sorts of other areas, not just the one that we kind of started the discussion with. Which I think takes us into a slightly different area of discussion, which I don't know whether you want to go into at this stage, but I would say in relation to capital punishment, it can be accommodated as long as we're still part of the European human rights system.
May I chime in? Just to be clear, I suppose, as Muslims who obviously reside in the West, the Sharia tells us that when you live in a land obviously not based under Islam, that we don't impose our beliefs on anyone. Even when within a land based on Islam, you don't impose your beliefs on anyone. We actually, you could say, pioneered multiple legal systems running parallel. So Jews living in the Islamic state and through history had their own legal system. Christians had their own legal system. Zoroastrians had their own legal system. Hindus, to various degrees, had their own legal system, and it was basically, between within communities, they were allowed to live and judge according to their own systems. And you know, this is historically documented, and this is how we kind of dealt with pluralism. If we said,
what happens in those situations then when, say, a Christian then does something to a Muslim, or a Muslim does something to a Christian, what law is there to deal with those, that mixing then? Because surely it's not always going to be Muslim on Muslim or Christian on Christian. What happens, does which law?
That would be according to the kind of the negotiated agreement prior to the incorporation of that community. So whenever, for example, Muslims, they deposed, let's say, Byzantine Romans controlling an area, and they, you know, liberate the people. And then the people, they came to a negotiation with these people, for example, and they said, all right, well, we'll live by X, Y, and Z, and you'll... and so on. If there's any disagreements or problems, we'll refer it to this or that, or this mutual compact. And this is how it was arranged. It was by negotiation, and then sticking to that agreement. The Constitution of Medina, which was the first constitution of the first Islamic State by the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, it was actually an agreement between Muslims and Jews in that first constitution. And so it talked about, you know, how they would relate and how they would not support enemies against each other, and how they would have, you know, provide mutual defense. So this is basically, and that was how you'd resolve it. Now, I think there's a philosopher, I think it was a William E. Connolly, who is a critique of secularism. He himself also advocates something very similar to this, which is basically that we exist in a plural of communities, and we kind of negotiate with each other how we kind of live with each other and coexist. And so that would be very much what the Sharia advocates. But just to finish my last point very quickly is, we don't believe in the imposition of our law system on people in a non-Islamic country, and we don't even believe it imposition in an Islamic country. And there's many times the Prophet Muhammad has said many words to this effect. He said, for example, anyone who oppresses or humiliates a non-Muslim citizen, he will not be entered into paradise, and many such quotations like this. So as Muslims, we can't impose it. And even in the Quran, it mentioned a time when some Jews went to the Prophet Muhammad for a judgment, for him to make a judgment between them. And he said basically to them, well, the Quran said in response, why are you coming to Muhammad for judgment when you have your Torah? So this is how Islam would deal with, you know, plurality of different opinions. We don't believe in this totalitarian one law for all, because who makes that? That law is certainly not made by all. It's only made by a few people, and it's according to their own biases and prejudices. So this is why Islam would, Islamic opinions would be, held.
Rami, do you have something to contribute?
Yeah, actually, I've got a two-part question for Abdullah, if you don't mind. Touching on your previous comments, the first question I suppose I would have is, when you mention how Sharia law is basically, it almost sounds to me like a libertarian kind of harm principle, where if whatever you do in your house, up to you, as long as it's not harming somebody else, as long as it's not shamed in the public sphere, so to speak. But what about in your own house, for example? If a young Muslim girl is caught by her father having sex before marriage with her boyfriend, and he beats her for his own pride and for the pride of his own family, how would Sharia deal with that? It happened in her household. But whose rights are more important than the rights of the father as, you know, head of that household, or the rights of that girl?
There's no conception of, I suppose you might say, the conception of honor. That's a more cultural conception. In Islam, we believe in respect, not the idea of honor. So someone, in Islam, we're taught to be, to have humility and not be prideful. Unfortunately, in many, countries today, which are Muslim, they have this very, non-Islamic cultural perspective. We believe is non-Islamic, and we believe it's due to many social reasons why it exists.
So how would Sharia, for example, punish that father for his behavior?
Well, I mean, the daughter would have to go to the state and ask for legal redress, and then it would be in accordance with, be up to a judge to decide as to the appropriate redress against the father and for the plaintiff. So just like in this society, Sharia is not a kind of libertarian concept. We don't believe in material harm and benefit. We believe, you could say, in the bigger picture harm and benefit. The Sharia is meant to aid people who want to live a religious life from not facing difficulties or being oppressed or prevented from doing so by other stimuli being enforced on them.
But wouldn't a state imposition, for example, on that father then be a stimuli? With then the state saying to him, why are you punishing your daughter? She has as much rights as you do. Would that not be him not being able to practice, for example, his religious beliefs? Like where do you draw the line?
No, that wouldn't be his religious beliefs, because Islam doesn't say that the father can beat his daughter, who's a fully grown adult. Let's say assuming she's adult, of course, to have a boyfriend.
She's a child, for example. What if she's like 14, 15, 16?
Well, in this society, if you have a boyfriend and you engage in sexual relations before you reach 16 years old in UK, that's actually punishable by British law.
Well, we have an age of consent, though.
Sorry?
We do have an age of consent.
Oh, you have.
The two parties, for example, are of the same age of consent legally.
And well, I guess one of the problems is when the parent argues that it is an integral part of his religious beliefs.
As an individual, rather than... Like, what would be an arbiter, a final arbiter, for example?
Okay, well, it's like this. I mean, I assume most people here are law students. Mm-hmm. And so, as you know, there's so many interpretations on the law. Who's the final authority that determines what actually is the law? Well, it would be the UK government.
Or the Supreme Court, for instance.
Yeah, by various means, that would then impose its interpretation of the principles of the law, and then we all have to accept. Even if you disagree with it, we all have to accept. Now, this is just a part of human, the human's, political, nature. There's no way avoiding. Someone has to say at one point, this is the interpretation we're going with. And the same thing in Islamic society, we have jurisprudence, and the jurisprudence, like in Western jurisprudence, would have to make a decision on the matter, and then this matter would then become adopted in the state law. It's not adopted for all time. We don't believe that the state authority is sinless or divinely guided. It's prone to human error, can be changed. But just like in Western legal systems, it will have to be adopted by the elite. That's why we have government. The government adopts the law.
But I mean, that does go against your statement when you said that Sharia doesn't abide by this one dictatorial law. You're saying it does the exact same thing as the Western laws, but then you're saying it doesn't do the exact same thing as the Western laws, and I guess that's what's causing me a bit of confusion.
No. One law for all right? Mm-hmm. Which means that one law for Christians, Jews, and Muslims, atheists and Buddhists and so on and so forth, even though, for example, atheists, Buddhists or Christians, Jews might not accept the basis for law. It would be wrong for me to say you must follow Islamic law because we're in power. Mm-hmm. That'd be wrong. So that's where is not this totalitarian one law for all. Within the Islamic discourse, generally speaking, it's accepted amongst different schools of thought within Islam that you can follow an opinion adopted by a leader. Mm-hmm. As long as he's a legitimate leader, i.e. a caliph, then he's allowed to adopt opinions, and you have to abide by them, even if you disagree, right? And so there's no difference of opinion amongst, Islamic schools of thought.
So theoretically, then the caliph is the final arbiter of the law.
In terms of not theologically, just politically.
Okay, so if your politics and your theology are bound together, then he's the final arbiter of the law.
No, not in terms of your private sphere, for example, how you pray and your spiritual worships and things, but just concerning only aspects of the law which the caliph can legislate upon, like in any government, which is basically, public transactions, economy, and so on and so
forth. But, for example, that caliph, are they publicly appointed or elected?
Yeah, they're elected by the people.
So can they be punished or removed?
Yes.
Okay, so it's very similar then to a Western system.
Yeah, but just a different ideological basis. We don't have liberalism as the basis of the society we have. It's Islamic.
But I mean,
belief.
For instance, on a Western scale, we don't really adopt a religious religion, like a religious law anymore. I mean, if you look at the ECHR, considering that it protects every single religion equally and has like no actual religious basis, and this concept of liberalism ought not to be looked at as if it's a religious theology, but actually just a concept of human life, well, then I don't see why this would be an imposition law. If a law in its sphere aims to make every single religion equal, ought that law not be adopted then because it is the fairest law?
Adding on top of that, could you see the potential, perhaps, and it's a bit of a slippery slope argument, of maybe this universal legal system perhaps dividing up into separate legal systems for beliefs or just cultural traditions, for instance? Like maybe a particular district adopts canon law, for instance. And then it sort of loses, if it's agreeability, and then you get this general idea of where's the arbitration, where's the higher arbiter in this? Can you see how this might tip the scales?
No, because, I mean, the underpinning of the state would be, obviously, the Islamic system that brings the state into being. And then, from that basis, then you'll have the negotiated agreements with the groups of people who don't follow the Islamic belief, so that they actually agree via negotiation to a particular way of coexistence. And, of course, yeah, you can have multiple factions. I mean, you know, many Christian factions only exist today because they were given a place to live outside of, you know, a very intolerant Europe at the time, who was basically persecuting different factions. But just to, I think, answer that one point you said, you say that the Western system isn't based on any particular, I should say, doctrine or dogma.
No, but I mean the ECHR.
ECHR.
There's tons of Western systems that are based on specifically, for example, Christian ideologies. But
sure. Well, I would actually contest that. I would say that deep in the bowels of liberalism, which underpins the ideological underpinning of the ECHR, you have concepts such as individualism, you know, which is a philosophical adoption, you know, on how to manage humans. You have equality as identicality. You know, which is an adoption. Not everyone believes that equality, in that interpretation of equality, and so on. You have the belief in moral agency, that we have free will and we can somehow make choices. This is a metaphysical concept. You know, actually, how are we even equal? In what way are we equal? Some are more intelligent than others. Some are stronger than others. Some have better immune system than others. Some are more genetically fit than others. Nature doesn't say we're equal. So where do we get this idea that we're equal from? Again, that's a relic from Christianity, which we've you know, usefully borrowed and are implementing.
Actually, many people would argue that the European law is based on Judeo-Christian ideology. So.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Obviously.
Gotta give them credit too.
And so,
if you don't mind, I'll move on to my second question then. The second question.
Save it for a bit later. I'm kind of hogging all the.
Well, actually, it deals with capital punishment, so maybe we should just deal with it now, if you don't mind.
Well, it's up to you.
I promise it's entertaining.
Well, I believe I'm. That man in the hoodie, I don't know your name, apologies.
I was just going back to avoiding the topic of body killings in this case, and you're saying it's cultural, not religious, but in the case of apostasy, which is definitely religious, and you're saying separate laws apply to separate religious groups, at what point in apostasy in Judeo-Christian or Islamic or Buddhist or, you know, any religion, at what point does that sort of legal system then suddenly change for them?
For apostate, okay, I think the whole conception of apostates is misunderstood within Islam. It's best translated as treason against the state. That is the better translation. I would refer to people to Surah 4, verse 88 in the Quran, if you want to make a note of that. And it discusses, what it says in that surah is that those people who basically want to change their religion, and they have changed their religion from Islam, and they don't want to fight against, you know, the Muslims or attack them or so on, so their hearts are restrained from physically fighting you, then, you know, leave them be. In fact, don't even tell them to come back to Islam, because God willed that they would leave Islam. So that's what it says. I don't like to make assertions without evidence. I know people might find it hard because the media has told you something else. So I'm giving you references. Surah 4, verse 88, read it yourself. It is a law against treason. And this law only applies under an Islamic state, because your treason has to be against the state. It can't be against anyone else.
I agree that it only applies under which Islamic law is actually implemented. My problem is the fact that it's implemented.
What? The law against treason is implemented?
No, the law of death for apostasy is implemented.
Well, I mean, theoretically, I think in America it's still outlawed treason, and in some places it could be killed. You could be killed for treason against the state. So
doesn't make it right.
Well, I don't think you have a basis to say it's wrong. That's my point.
Okay. You say that it's fairer to kill someone than make them stay in prison for the rest of their life, but wouldn't it be fairer and, you know, more in favour of their right to life if you said it was up to them to decide whether they wanted to have the life sentence or be given the death penalty, and also especially if they have family, you know, and indeed children? It's incredibly unfair to the family to make them suffer in that way.
Okay, so you ask, should the person who executed someone, murdered somebody, be given a choice to whether they could spend life in a jail or be executed? I don't think they offer that choice to their victim as to whether they should have continued life or not. So I don't think the choice is up to them. I think the choice is up to those who remain behind, who are aggrieved by that action, which is the family, the victim's family, and they can choose to forgive or not. Maybe the guy can make a plea, or the girl, can make a plea to the victim's family as to whether why he should be forgiven or not, or what have you. But I don't think you should give criminals a choice about how they're punished.
But
no system does that.
But you're arguing that they should be given the death penalty on the grounds that it's fairer. But then,
no, it's more humane.
Well, okay, but then wouldn't it be equally humane to give them the choice? Shouldn't they be able to decide what's humane?
And what if they were wrongfully convicted?
Yeah.
That's why in the capital punishments in Islam, the criteria for proof is so high that for most of these crimes, it's hard, you can't prosecute. It's not even a viable law to prosecute. The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam even commanded Muslims, saying, "Find any excuse you can to let someone off of a capital punishment."
Okay. I'd just like to open up the discussion just a bit more generally. So recently we've seen a lot of sensationalist and emotional headlines about certain religious practices or even traditional practices being undermined or completely abolished due to offence of other religious groups. I mean, a lot of these are, to be frank, Daily Mail headlines, but I mean, there's a few choice examples like France's abolition of the burqa, for instance, Germany's bill, which initially planned to abolish religious-based circumcision, although that's now been relaxed slightly to it being okay until the age of six, until then after that age it's going to a doctor. But my general question is, do you feel that states have a right to intervene in these religious practices if there's it causes any discomfort or particular offence to some citizens, for instance? Do you think that's a right by the state?
Just to the whole panel, sorry.
No. I'll keep it short, but I don't think so. The right to freedom of expression under the ECHR and all international human rights instruments includes the right to be offensive. There is, however, as I said earlier, and as you all probably know, the right to manifest one's religious belief is not an absolute right. It can be limited in order to protect rights. So it might be the rights of children. It might be the rights of other people. It might be in the interests of public order, etc. But I think purely on the grounds that it's offensive to other citizens is hugely problematic, particularly when we consider that human rights is particularly important. Human rights are particularly important for minorities and to protect against majority. Majority rule.
Okay. Another example would be Amnesty International, for instance, fighting against religious circumcisions, describing them as male genital mutilation. Rabbi, how would you feel about that certain point, the fact that an international institution is coming at your sacred religious practices in such a quite a cold way? How would you propose that they be a bit more sensitive, let's
say? Okay, going back to your comment about the German law, this connects with what you're asking me specifically. It's important to know that law was a regional law, not a national law. It's only for the Cologne region, not for the whole of Germany. And it was overruled by Angela Merkel as a part of looking at the bigger picture, if you want. And I think it's essential, in answer to your question, that when you talk about human rights and you talk about understanding all the aspects of human rights, which Elizabeth just pointed out, you look at everything, at all the aspects. There's the nine different categories of human rights, and one's human rights is not less or more important than another's. And it's essential that these organizations, including Amnesty International, look at the bigger picture, they look at the bigger context, and understand. You can't come and say circumcision sounds odd. I find circumcision to be extremely difficult to understand on a scientific or psychological level, on a personal level. I hate blood. I hate watching. When a doctor gives me a shot, I find extremely painful. I cringe, I hold on to the chair. I don't like blood. For somebody to turn around and say, it seems odd. Yeah, of course it seems odd, but you have to look at the bigger picture and say, you know, what's the context? 4,000 years of a practice which is very important and an essential part of a religious belief. Look at the bigger picture. And I think the chief rabbi in his plea to Angela Merkel, which from what I understand was one of the biggest factors in her response, was that it doesn't come across that the court in Cologne were looking at the bigger picture at all. If they were familiar with the bigger picture, they would have either commented on certain aspects of the bigger picture or they wouldn't have come to their conclusion. And it's essential, if we want human rights to work, which I believe the Jewish community in the UK and in Europe and around the world wants it to work, it's essential that all aspects of human rights are taken into account, everyone's human rights. It's my human right to be circumcised. I spoke to a solicitor yesterday who has a strong interest in human rights. I said to him, if my parents had made the choice not to circumcise me until I'm 18, I said, don't circumcise me when I'm 8 days old because it's a violation of my human rights. When I was 18, could I take them to the human rights court? Because when I'm 18, it's extremely more painful and extremely more difficult to undergo circumcision. He paused and he said, that's a perfectly reasonable argument. You just have to hope that the judge in the case is not prejudiced and is going to listen to both sides of the argument. Thankfully, my parents circumcised me when I was 8 days old. But
going on the basis then, if it's just done by tradition, you have 4,000 years, are you also in support of female genital mutilation that's done in tribal areas for many thousands of years?
I've spoken to a girl who lived in Africa for 3 years. To make the comparison is very, very dangerous. I'm not saying that you're making the comparison in the context that many people do.
Is the point of something that you said that because it's done by tradition for 4,000 years, so that should be taken into account?
This is done
in tribal areas.
What I said was that every aspect of the tradition has to be taken into account. You can't look in isolation at any specific aspect. As far as female mutilation, as I said, I've spoken to a girl who lived in an area in Africa where this is practiced. And she's a traditional Jew who says she would circumcise her boys no problem, and she sees what goes on over there. She says the comparison is simply incomparable in every level. And it's important that Amnesty International and those organizations that are looking at these questions look at that honestly and say, are we just putting it into the same emotive, reactive bundle, or are we looking at every single aspect of it and taking everything into account?
I think there's also some other kind of angle on the matter. I mean, it's people believe that liberalism as ideology is defined by its tolerance, but by necessity it actually is intolerant, and it has to be by its creed, because if something is not liberal according to liberal worldview, that's injustice, and then how can liberalism tolerate injustice? And hence it has to then start to impose itself or deny other systems to exist because they're not liberal. So communism will be a natural enemy, or during the MacArthur eras, this is how they would limit it. Again, we see that the ECHR have accepted a lot of these intolerances in Europe under certain principles, which are also in the articles of the convention, such as obviously the protection of public morals, and what is necessary in a democracy. Well, a very ambiguous term. What is necessary in a democracy? I suppose Hitler did what he thought was necessary in a Nazi democracy, because he was voted into power. The Nazis were voted into power. I find that completely dubious. We see, for example, that the minaret bans were upheld by the ECHR. We see that the banning of political groups, non-violent political groups like Rafah Party in Turkey and Hizb ut-Tahrir in Germany, I think, they're banned from making public associations and things, was upheld because these groups weren't liberal and so didn't deserve to be protected by liberalism because they were an existential threat. Their ideology, even though they're non-violent, is an existential threat and can't be protected. A woman who wanted to go into learn in school and university with her hijab in Turkey was banned and prevented from doing so in Turkey, and the ECHR upheld that ban, saying that was necessary for the democracy of Turkey. So these kind of things, I think, is an intolerance there. But just regarding what you mentioned about parents and kids and how that kind of works, this is very interesting because kids obviously haven't reached the age of maturity, and so according to, you know, most political philosophies in the world, you know, they can't make free choices for themselves. So then who makes free choices on their behalf for their betterment? It's their parents. So the parent might believe, according to their own conception of what is good, which liberalism says it supposedly doesn't get involved with people's conceptions of good, that the parent says, right, I want my kid to be a Jew or to be a Muslim or whatever, and they will have to undergo circumcision. Okay. But then that's all fine until liberalism says, wait a second, but maybe later on, if the kid doesn't want to be, then you've kind of denied their free choice. So according to the liberal model of what is freedom, we're going to, at some point, they're going to start intervening in how parents raise their children. Maybe one day even saying that teaching your kid a religion is taking away their freedom of conscience, and so on. So some atheists have argued this as well. So I'm saying, where does it stop? This is a kind of a scope creep of liberalism into people's lives, micromanaging the people, how they interact, and so on and so forth. And I think it's quite dangerous, so just something to bear in mind.
Just with regard to that point, where do you stand on the issue that if both parents are consenting to a ritual circumcision or any sort of medical procedure, then the procedure is considered perfectly legitimate and the practice illegal? But it is only when one parent agrees and one parent disagrees that either a court will intervene or there is any intervention at all. Where do you stand on the idea that, from a human rights aspect, let's just say a circumcision can amount to per se trespass and it could be actionable? Where do you draw the line that the rights of the individual parents should be what is discussed and the rights of the child are somewhat set aside only because the parents disagree? Why is it that the child's rights are completely ignored when the parents are in agreement, but it's only their rights considered when the parents have a disagreement or they...
That's based on an assumption that the child's rights are being denied. All you need to do is ask anyone who's been circumcised whether they feel that their rights have been denied. I have absolutely no problem with an adult who was circumcised when they were 8 days old taking their parents to a human court, rights court, and winning, as far as I'm concerned. But the majority, who are quite happy being circumcised, would, as I said earlier, have the right to do the reverse if they weren't circumcised. And I think that it's vital that we recognize the importance of the Human Rights Act and the Equality Act and all of these things that enable every minority and every majority to be able to go about their lives and do what they believe in and what they think is important. All of these, you know, it's very interesting. For me, this has been fascinating. I don't study law. And looking into this whole thing the last couple of days and doing research and preparation for this discussion has been really interesting for me. And I'm very grateful to be able to live in Europe and in the UK, and I know that the Jewish community have been advocating for the needs of their community for well over 2,000 years. We've been living under the rule of other countries for well over 2,000 years. The Hebrew word shtadlanim, which means advocates within the Jewish community who communicate with the leaders or the state or whoever it is, has been going on for a very, very long time and very successfully all over the world, sometimes not so successfully to our detriment, sadly. But by and large, and certainly today, I think we're very grateful and we're very lucky. And I would say that we're able to communicate our message on a national level, on an international level, and I think that's a great thing.
And can I just to clarify, I mean, I think one of the reasons is the way human rights law operates. Normally we think of human rights cases as being brought against the state. So cases are brought to the European Court of Human Rights against the UK. Under the Human Rights Act, there's an action for judicial review against public authorities if they breach an individual's rights. And human rights only come into play in cases between private individuals or in criminal cases, etc., once cases are already in court. So I guess in terms of legal, it only becomes an issue when someone brings a case for trespass against the person, or because they're not bringing a case against their parents, it's the state.
Okay, well, following on from that then, you said you would be happy for anyone who ended up seeing that their ritual circumcision was wrong to bring a case and winning. What would you?
But the case would have to be against the UK, wouldn't it?
Of course, yeah. But what do you say to people whose opinions change? For example, if someone has had a ritual circumcision at 8 days old, and they have lived for 30 years, completely fine with the decision. It may never have never even crossed their mind. But then they start to read into political and social philosophy, and they then decide, well, actually, this is wrong. I know we have a statute of limitations to try and deal with this aspect, but there's this whole idea of data knowledge as to when they see this idea as wrong. Are you saying there should be an idea of accession to the capricious nature of people as to, because someone one day decides that what has been done to them is wrong, their rights should still be upheld 30, 50, however many years later? Is it just as important even if the event is so long ago? That's to anybody who wishes.
No. As far as I'm concerned, a judge would have to judge that. I don't really need to hear the professional legal opinion. Absolutely, if somebody turns around at the age of 70 and says, I feel my human rights have been denied, the court would have to listen. I don't know what the court would rule is
for the legal profession.
Well, they have to
have
a cause of action to bring a case in domestic courts, and mostly there's time limitations in terms of when cases can be brought. Somebody looked into this for their moot, who was it?
Was
you, <yeah. laughs> So you probably know as much as I do about it.
For example, you knew the scenario he was trying to play out. Like, let's say somebody's raised as a practicing conservative or, I guess, Orthodox Jew, and at the age of, let's say, 16, 17, they decide, I'm thinking that there's no God now, I'm an atheist. They become an adult. Now they're an adult, so they can bring cases on their own. So they say, from that date of knowledge that they find out, oh, I no longer believe in this religion, I'm not going to regrow back my foreskin. I don't even know if there's plastic surgeons that'll even touch that with a 10-foot pole. But speaking of, but anyway, so if they bring a case against their parents saying they made a decision against my autonomy to have a part of me removed that I will never get back, I don't believe what they believe, from, I guess, a Jewish perspective, was a harm caused to that person? Or were the parents acting in the best interest?
From a human rights perspective.
From both. From a human rights perspective, we know if you do something to someone that was not necessary to be done and in no way in their best interest, and it caused them harm.
The question is, to me, whether I would embrace the human rights court's view of it and they're enabling this individual to present their case. And my answer is absolutely, and I would say to any parent who's considering circumcising their child, that you have a responsibility to teach your child, that your child should grow up understanding and appreciating why you did that to them. Otherwise, you should really question whether you're doing the right thing or not. Mm-hmm. Not just because you might end up in a human rights court with a big bill, but because is it right to circumcise your child and then not give your child any background knowledge or appreciation of why you've done that?
What if they have done their best, though? And the child just chooses not to believe.
They'll have to get some very good lawyers, and I would be back.
But I mean, the danger is...
I'm very comfortable living in the West.
What I mean is the danger is if a court says, yes, you know what, the parents acted wrong, it's setting a precedent saying that maybe because they acted in the name of Judaism, that acting like that in the name of Judaism is wrong.
But is the court likely to say yes when you looked into it?
Depends on the court. Cologne obviously did, but I mean, I'm pretty sure not every court would. But as, for example, Abdullah was saying, things change in liberalism. Our concept of these things might change in 10, 15 years. Or what I'm trying to ask the rabbi is, where would Judaism stand if you once again see, for example, the ECHR making a monumentous decision saying circumcisions are wrong? And this can be to both of you, because I know in Islam you circumcise as well, correct?
Yeah.
So, I mean, at that point, how much of an affront is that to religion, as opposed to an individual's rights to not have their body trespassed against?
Well, you raise a great question. I absolutely love it because it brings another example. Who defines what was wrong with that? If a child grows up, becomes adult, becomes an atheist, falls out with their parents, hates their parents, wants to get back at their parents, and goes to say, I'm going to take you to the court. You denied my right to whatever, the court would have to decide what is the conception of a good life, or conception of human nature, or conception of what a human should be, and then make a judgment saying, well, you've gone against this model. And then the court and the state cease to become neutral. I don't think they're neutral anyway, but they become even less neutral about all these philosophical questions, and they start getting themselves involved. I think that, and besides, as to contradicting a child's autonomy, I know that's a kind of obviously a liberal philosophical point of view. The child's autonomy is gone against every single day by their parents. you know, not being allowed to eat what they want, not be allowed to dress what they want. Maybe they don't want to go to school. Maybe they want homeschooling, or maybe they don't want homeschooling. They want to go to school. Maybe they don't like to eat the food that's been made by their mum, and want to have some other kind of food. Whatever. Right? Every day the child's autonomy is being contradicted by the parents and so on.
But not in a non-reversible way, though.
I'm going to have to cut you off.
Sorry,
the man who's been waiting.
I was just going to ask, what medical evidence do you have to support your claim, which is that an 8-day-year-old baby feels somehow less pain than an 18-year-old person, apart from the fact that they can say no?
I'm sitting here. and I've spoken to adults who have been circumcised. I have no recollection of my circumcision whatsoever. I couldn't walk for about 18 months afterwards, but that was with the
So, actually, you could even argue that the medical benefit, there are medical benefits with circumcision. Obviously, you know, it prevents cancer. You're less susceptible. It helps prevent penile cancer. It helps prevent penile cancer. Yes.
By the way,
I wasn't going to go down this route.
But all you need to do, you might argue that the NHS is biased. You're very welcome to do so. But if you look on the NHS website under circumcision and see what they write, if you're prepared to look at it honestly, it seems to be implying that they are in support of circumcision for medical reasons.
STDs as well.
I don't support
it. Impede STDs, communicable STDs. I mean, yes, it's not an absolute, obviously, you know, shield or barrier against all those things. But people have, you know, wish it was, but... There is empirical evidence as to lower rates, and that's it. This is actually not really that disputed amongst them in the medical profession. I didn't even know there was any dispute on it until that gentleman said it was. But deferring to those who I don't know if you're scientists, but deferring to the scientists, this is what they say. So okay, that's not why I believe, you know, people should be allowed to do circumcision. I don't advocate. That's not my basis. I'm just saying it's just an interesting kind of anecdote anyway.
I mean, I think what is interesting is the reason we're having this debate is linked to the point you made about the trend in the jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights, which is to find that there hasn't been a violation of the right to manifest freedom of religion, because they've deferred to the state's kind of margin of appreciation in relation to the ban on the minarets and the wearing of the headscarf. And actually it is quite conceivable that this is an issue that the European Court of Human Rights will look at and decide actually there is a human rights issue here. And that's, I think that's really interesting, because we wouldn't have had this debate 6-7
I would point out just quickly as well that the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, Article 24.3, if you're interested, does state, states parties shall take effective and appropriate measures with a view to abolishing traditional practices prejudicial to the health of the children, which could possibly, obviously, I mean...
We'd have to argue that it's prejudicial.
Well, in the case, in the German course, the boy bled out, which is why he had to go to a hospital. I would say that was very prejudicial to his health at that time.
Yeah. Well, that's not related to circumcision per se.
Well, if you're a bad doctor with bad medical practices, I mean, is that the fault of the medical practice, or the fault of the doctor who made a mistake or was incompetent? I think that doesn't really hold water.
But just what you're saying about the UN Charter on Rights of the Child, does it not also state that it is a parent's right to decide the religious upbringing for their child? If it is then a necessity of that religion that the child then be circumcised, how do you deal with the clashing of those two apparently equally important rights?
Well, you have a similar problem, though, in the European Convention of Human Rights, though, that if you have a protection of freedom of expression, freedom of thought, and what have you, but that defers to the rights of things not to be persecuted, not to be discriminated against, and, you know, their rights not to be attacked by other people. You know, there are clashes within... the rights, and I guess it's going to have to be up to the courts to decide which one of those takes precedence. But I mean, I guess violence against a person would, I think, be a right that takes precedence over a right to
circumcision. Taking the religious element out of it, if a circumcision was done without permission, it would, especially in English criminal law, account to a wounding under Section 20 of the Offence Against the Person Act. So that's clearly something that is causing. Yes. Clearly, that is something that is causing a distinct, some would say, harm to the child.
So, if a secular child, as I said earlier, there's certain things that I'm still learning. This has been a great learning curve for me. If a secular couple in the UK circumcise their child because of what the perceived medical benefits. They looked at the NHS website and they said, circumcision is the way to go. It will save our child all sorts of potential complications further down the road. How would that play out in human rights court?
Well, from my reading anyway, would be consent to a standard medical procedure and would therefore be considered a legitimate process.
Or if it was medically necessary, for example, if the foreskin was too tight.
Well, I'm not talking about if there was a complication.
I'm talking about from a theoretical standpoint, a circumcision is a procedure that can amount to either criminal proceedings or it is something that some people can argue causes a degree of harm, be it physical or even sometimes psychological later on in life. It was just an idea of if that is something that can, by definition, cause a degree of harm, then clearly it's a violation of the right of the child under the UN Charter. But if it's also correct in saying that it is the right of the parent to pick the religious upbringing of that child, and it's a necessity of their religious belief to have your child circumcised, we surely have a conflict of interests in the sense that we have to decide whose autonomy is more important. Whose religious ideology should be upheld or whose individual autonomy should be upheld.
But I mean, human rights is all about balancing of rights. I mean, the freedom of expression, privacy cases involving the media. You know, two parties have rights. How do you balance them? And the answer is none of these rights are absolute rights. But we do know, I mean, for example, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child refers to, if I remember correctly, it doesn't use the term parental rights. It's referring to, it recognises the kind of role that parents play in relation to providing guidance in relation to certain issues. And so there's always, that's about, human rights is all about competing rights. You know, nearly every human rights decision involves competing rights, and the courts have to decide which right prevails. And how the rights should be interpreted and applied in a particular situation.
Well, as I said, I mean, this is where the state gets involved in people's conceptions of good. What is the basis for determining whether something is good or bad? Again, you know, the state or liberalism itself is not actually partial. It's not actually neutral. It just, you know, portrays itself as such, but it's not. Generally speaking, I think the more preeminent philosophy is secular humanism in the West. It has the top dog status of determining what is right and wrong. All other philosophical traditions don't have that same top dog status and have to now defer to its, kind of totalitarian philosophy, a rule in that sense.
I'm sure, but you look a bit distressed.
I'm just wondering on what basis you're making that claim, considering particularly in this country where we still have bishops in the House of Lords and we still have the head of state as the head of the church. What basis is secular humanism?
I don't know when the last time the Queen issued a fatwa, but she might have. Just give examples. So
let's take more like you said about, you know, parents. Parents obviously should be prohibited from if it's part of a tradition to kind of obviously harm their child or mutilate their child or so on and so forth. Well, I think that means that we should ban McDonald's and taking your kids to McDonald's because it's actually bad for the health of the child to take them to McDonald's or all these sugary drinks and sugars and so on, causing attention deficit disorders and all such problems. What about piercings, ear piercings for girls as well? That's also harming the person. You could say, you know, it's harming their, you know, kind of physical, their vestigial attribute of skins and things like that. Obviously, the foreskin is vestigial. It's not part of the, obviously, some kind of, it's not linked into any sensory aspects of the child's pleasure, you know, pleasure, you know, erogenous zones.
I don't argue with that, actually.
Yeah, so, all right, that's fine. Well, all right, but I mean, the question really here in the West is more about choice. So you can have plastic surgery. Right, labioplasties, which is pretty much dealing, you know, filling with someone's genitals, and I'm not referring to the fun sense of that term. So, you know, but these things in itself are not actually the source of, are not to be condemned intrinsically in the West, right? It's always about the choice. That's the only question. Is it, did you choose it? Did you not choose it? That's the real question. Not if you actually mutilate. I could cut my arm off if I wanted to in the West. and they wouldn't. I wouldn't be locked in jail. I could even tell my friend to cut my arm off and give and make consent for this. And my friend wouldn't be jailed for that. So really, it's not the actual kind of self-flagellation or mutilation aspect. It's the autonomy aspect.
You wouldn't end up in jail, but you might end up in a mental hospital.
probably.
At this point, you might end up in jail. It's illegal to actually behave in any kind of manner. You can't consent to a grievous bodily harm. If you ask your friend to cut your arm off, you're both probably going to be jailed. Well, you'll go to an insane asylum.
I understand what you're saying, that it's quite hard to draw the line. I think firstly we can be a bit more pragmatic than that, and I think some things are a bit more transient than others. But I was going to ask, do you really think perhaps circumcising a child at a young age, maybe even teaching them why they've been circumcised, but at the same time teaching them about the religion, and then accepting if they want to make a Court of Human Rights claim at the age of 18, do you really think that's the same as leaving them completely uncircumcised and sort of, I don't want to say indoctrinated, but spoken to from a very young age about religion, and then, you know, allowing them to decide? I mean, obviously people are affected by the environment, but even just teaching them why they've been circumcised, that doesn't give them complete free will, because no doubt any parent who's gone and wanted to do that will, you know, impose their own views, and subsequently the child's autonomy. Is that real autonomy?
Well, that's what I remember. What I said earlier on, which is that what I might see coming around the corner is that the state gets involved in how parents look raise their children, and saying you can't impose it on them or teach them any particular prejudice or bias except state sanctioned bias and prejudice, which reminds me of certain 20th century states which did the same thing. And do we really want to go down that road? You know, is that the future for liberalism? You know, liberalism, the word just becomes ironic after a while. I think it's just we have to do some soul searching, I think, with regards to how we actually live as human beings. And the more fundamental, I think we check our more fundamental, you know, kind of assumptions about how to organize human beings, rather than just say, right, well, we have liberalism, okay, it's not properly working, but let's just see how we can get the best out of a bad system. Whereas why not just question, maybe there's another way of life to look at, another different political philosophy to look at, because these are fundamental problems and contradictions occurring, and people are going to jail over this. People are being denied what they see is their conscience, following their conscience. And I think these things, you know, should kind of be taken very seriously. I think we should start questioning rather the root of what we hold to be secure, checking our own dogmas and seeing if those dogmas really hold up to intellectual scrutiny.
I think that's the beauty of liberalism, though, is that you can question the authority, you can question the rules. You know, it's constantly changing. There's no this is it and this is going to be it forever.
Can you challenge liberalism itself in the West?
Well, yeah. Are you not now?
No, I mean, I'm okay. Yeah. All right, then tell that to Rafah Party. Tell that to the group Hizb ut-Tahrir, who were banned because of they hold values which were fundamentally against secularism or viewed as inimicable to democracy. They were banned. So they weren't given that that toleration. Sure, I mean, most societies will tolerate kind of fringe elements until these fringe elements become more significant and more. Like for example, you know, prior to the MacArthur era, no one really obviously kind of went after communists. But during the Soviet Union and when actually communism was actually viewed as a real existential threat, then they started to kind of persecute and oppress communists. And America's actually meant to be more free a country than England, and they were doing that in America. So all I'm saying is that. Liberalism is not actually tolerant. The Muslim community. I mean, look at what David Cameron said from Munich about muscular liberalism, the need now for muscular liberalism, and he's talked about a whole bunch of ways and means to start tackling Muslim extremism, i.e. A holistic Islam, because Islam has a political aspect to it. The Jewish law has a political aspect to it, but that's not really applied anymore to any great degree, I think, in a state level anyway. Most religions actually had a political aspect to them in the past, right? It's anachronistic to think that religion only maybe Islam does, but everyone else doesn't, or anyone who believes that religion and politics is the same is an extremist. No, I mean, you know, that's just what it always has been in amongst humanity.
But that's what could I just also comment with that
at the end of the day, I think it's essential that you look at the people who have been circumcised and you ask them this question. As was mentioned, the Cologne ruling was based on people who didn't have any interest in circumcision, and were concerned about the medical issues of a child who had a medical problem as a result, challenging it. We're not talking about a mass number of Jews who were circumcised or individuals who were circumcised who are now going to the human rights court saying this should be abolished. You're talking about people who don't recognize, were not circumcised, and have a massive problem with it. As far as I'm concerned, those who are circumcised should have the equal right to argue their case in the human rights court.
I'm just going to do a few quick questions. Tom.
Hi. Well, first off, I'd like to apologise for the volume of my incredulity. I realise that may have come across as a bit rude. But secondly, these metaphysical ideas that you say underlie Sharia, the anti-individualistic, socially determined skepticism about free will, if you have all those elements, how then can you have a conception of blame and responsibility?
I think you misunderstood me. I'm all for moral agency. And I don't believe in that, in absolute non-individualism or communalism or something. I believe that humans are kind of somewhere in between being, individuals and society. I think that we are social animals, social creatures. We have mirror neurons in our mind, in our brains, which mean that we have a propensity to kind of imitate other human beings around us. We were made, so to speak, to be kind of plugged into to human society, basically. So to believe that in this kind of pre-social position, humans were these kind of disembodied individuals, which now come into society, you have to protect this metaphysical idea of this individual. It doesn't exist. It never has existed, and it has led to a malformation of a political idea in philosophy, and that's caused lots of problems. Because and I didn't just realize this. Libertarianism kind of morphed into social liberalism now when they realized that people don't get along if you just leave them by themselves, just guarantee their rights, not for the state not to interfere. You have to start micromanaging people to stop them hating each other, stop the mass prejudices and discriminations and social oppression rather than just state oppression. So the liberal philosophers themselves realized that there was problems with these philosophies, not just me saying it. But I think there's one thing I did say. I've made an assertion. I've backed up with a few evidences from contemporary circumstances. But when I mentioned that liberalism is naturally intolerant to other political ideologies, this is not just a modern phenomenon or a few bad eggs. This is, liberal philosophers have been saying this for a long time. So, John Milton railed against Catholics, saying that you shouldn't tolerate Catholics. And this guy who wrote his, if I can pronounce it properly, Areopagitica, which was meant to be a great discourse on freedom and freedom of conscience, but he was not tolerant to Catholics, saying that they were an existential threat, because Catholicism was viewed as a political force in Europe. John Locke said that atheists and Mohammedans shouldn't be tolerated, because then they are also an existential threat to the liberal paradigm. And again, as I said, David Cameron in his Munich speech, let me read out one passage. He goes, "A passively tolerant society says to its citizens, as long as you obey the law, we will leave you alone. I wish that was the case. However," he continues, "it stands neutral between different values. But a genuinely liberal country does much more. Unfortunately, it's that much more which I find rather threatening."
Sorry, could I just backtrack a bit? So you do believe in free will then?
Yeah, moral agency, yeah.
How can you have free will without an entity to manifest that free will, an individual entity to manifest that free will?
Well, individual is that what we believe is the soul, really, in terms of making choice. The choice resides within the soul. But think of it more in analogy as the human body is made up of a number of cells. Each of these cells, it has its own power source, and it does its own actions according to genetic code, of course. There are, generally speaking, they work within, obviously, a bigger framework, according to this genetic code, where they all kind of cooperate so that the greater organism obviously functions. But you do have cells that want to do their own thing. And we have a name for these cells, and they're called cancer. You see? So Islam views human society as like a human body, basically. There are, there's aspects of you which are individual and aspects of you which are social. If you keep whatever you're sinning to yourself and into your privacy of your own home, the political aspects of Sharia won't have any concerns with you. It's between you and God, and that's where your moral agency between you and God will be accounted.
Between you and yourself, that is.
Between you and God. Yeah. But okay, but in terms of your public actions, they actually affect others and they impinge on others. So if I make life more difficult for someone else by giving them temptations, by depriving them of economic resources due to concentration of wealth, a whole number of aspects I could impinge on society without directly physically hurting people, then this is where the Sharia will step in and kind of guarantee people's natural rights according to the Islamic conception of what the natural rights are. Now, obviously, Islam is not neutral in the aspect of what is deserved by human beings. But any political system to be viable can't be neutral. So I don't mind. You know what? I don't actually mind that liberalism is partial and biased on these matters. I just wish it was honest about it. I'd accept that. If they say, look, we're banning burqas, we're banning hijabs, we're banning minarets, because, you know, this is our system, and you don't like it, that's tough. I say, all right, fine, at least you're honest about that. But they say, no, we're neutral and free, but you can't do this, and that, according to what, because we don't like it. Well, I don't like that kind of, you know, hypocrisy. That's what I'm really complaining about.
Corey,
you
have a question?
Okay. Yeah, just firstly, I didn't think you totally clarified on what the apostasy issue earlier, because obviously there is this current problem of Christian minorities, places such as like Northern Nigeria and Pakistan, who are getting killed for exercising their faith, and also Muslims who are converting to Christianity. And you mentioned Surah Al-Muhammad talks about how we should let them go, but this is hardly being implemented anyway. Are they just wrongly interpreting this, or are they actually just adhering to what's always been the case in a lot of Islamic societies where other religious minorities are just being oppressed or suppressed? And secondly, just to Dr. Craig, what's your personal opinion on how far the state should get themselves involved in private religious affairs?
Okay, well, I'll just answer the first question. Sorry for hogging the table on this. Boko Haram are more reaction to a post-colonial phenomenon. And now, they were angry actually initially about Western education and secularism being imposed upon Muslims in Nigeria. And there's also problems between North-South divide, the South, the richer South, which are mainly Christian. During colonial era, they were more favoured by the British. Obviously, favoured those who followed their co-religionists. They favoured more than obviously the natives or native religions. And so there's all this resentment there. There's a lot of this post-colonial. It has nothing to do with Islam. In fact, amongst Muslim communities, Boko Haram are viewed as heretics who attack Muslim communities and impose. It's not even an Islamic interpretation. They just impose this general anti-Western fanaticism. So fanatically they are anti-West that they'll attack anything they think is Western, irrespective of whether Islam says you should or shouldn't or anything like that. In terms of Pakistan, Pakistan is, I would say, is close to a failed state than anything else. You have vigilantism, you have prejudice leading to people being killed, attacked, Muslims being killed and attacked by other Muslims. Everyone's being killed and attacked. And just to highlight, but there are Christians being killed and attacked too. In Pakistan, you can't really cite that. Islamic Sharia is not really being applied anywhere in the world. The only
Sharia that you are holding is theoretically.
It was never theoretical in the past. It was practical. The Ottoman caliphate and the previous caliphates. Well, in Islam, the Islamic state is a caliphate. If you don't see a state that's a caliphate, that's not an Islamic state. It has no Islamic authority. The reason why a lot of these states are very oppressive to their people is because they lack any religious authority. So what they try to do is they try to actually even in Iran.
Sorry.
All right.
Could you move on to your second question?
Thank you.
Do you want to say your question again?
Yeah.
I've got my answer, but I just wanted to.
Regardless of the first point, how far should the state, under the sort of current ECHR framework, implant itself into religious people's affairs, or such circumcision, or
I mean, I'm going to give a very general answer. I think the right to religious freedom is a very important right, because of its just the importance that religion holds in terms of people's ways of life and ways of thinking, and I think that the right to freedom of religion does include the right to change one's religion, and my kind of own view is that any restrictions on the right to manifest one's religious belief should be need to be clearly justified. and that we need to question any attempts to interfere with religious freedom. And yet, sometimes it's necessary. Sometimes it is necessary. I think it's a human rights law in a democratic society. But I don't agree with the answers to that question that have been given by the European Court of Human Rights, for example. I don't think the European Court of Human Rights is doing enough to uphold religious freedom. So it's quite a general question, but I think we should be very cautious about allowing the state to intervene too much.
On that point then, particularly with the case in the European Court, does that include the two in which they were discriminating against homosexual couples?
Can you just clarify who the they is that you're talking about?
Oh, well, it's the Relate case where...
Which who are the they that you're saying are discriminating against homosexual couples?
Oh, the people that refused,
So you're saying that the individuals who brought the case arguing that their right to freedom of religion had been restricted were discriminating on the grounds of sexual orientation?
Yes.
And what was your question again?
you said you disagreed with the judgments in those cases.
I didn't say those cases. I said religious freedom cases generally.
I thought you were referring to the four cases that had just been.
Disagree with the judgment in relation to the registrar, where the council introduced, when the Civil Partnerships Act was passed, this is the registrar who was required then to perform civil partnerships. She argued that was contrary to her religious beliefs, and also I think that she had been discriminated against on the grounds of her religious belief because she faced a sanction for so doing. But the European Court of Human Rights held that her rights hadn't been. You'll have to keep checking on getting it right. The European Court of Human Rights held that her rights hadn't been violated. And I didn't agree with that particular aspect of the judgment, but I did agree in relation to the Relate counsellor who knew when he started undergoing training to do the psychosexual therapy that his clients or the potential clients might include gay couples. Mm-hmm. And so I think there is a difference in those two cases. And I think the European Court of Human Rights got it wrong in relation to Ms. Liddell. But I think it got it right in relation to the other.
Do you not think that I appreciate that the law changed after she had the job and so she was working in that job for a while, but do you not think that working for the state specifically that she should be required to oblige by those laws?
No, because I think that her beliefs could have been accommodated. And I think this idea of reasonable accommodation of religious beliefs in the workplace is appropriate. But that's because I hold I think the right to religious freedom is important.
Yeah.
And I think it's being gradually undermined. But I also think the right to equality is important. If it hadn't been possible to accommodate that and people were actually going to be turned away and be told, sorry, you can't have a civil partnership ceremony here, I would say, that's not right. And the local authority clearly has a duty to provide that. So.
I come back to the Sharia, the Sharia law thing. I'm sure people are familiar that there are Jewish courts in the UK. And you never hear the question, why Jewish courts? So I just want to clarify that. It's been fascinating hearing how the Sharia law is being proposed to be accepted. I know there was just last night in the news something about the state of Florida rejecting Sharia law and it just going past. In the UK, I'm sure it's similar elsewhere in Europe and in the US. The Jewish courts operate under the Arbitration Act, and that's the only jurisdiction that they have. So, I mean, I don't know how familiar everyone is with the Arbitration Act, but it's either arbitration or mediation, and they have to follow all the criteria with the contracts and mutual consent from both sides, etc., etc. And as far as I'm concerned, if Sharia law wanted to have such a setup of arbitration law, I wouldn't have a problem with that.
Sure. As I do, it's what I was invited for today.
Okay, concerning there was a Christian individual who didn't want to counsel what's called a gay couple
because it went against their conscience. Well, see, here's the thing. If we have a right to earn our livelihood. So if you now saying that, okay, well, we're going to fire these people because they're acting according to their conscience, you're denying them a right to livelihood. I think John Stuart Mill said that's not just locking people up, which is one form of oppression, also denying them a form of their right to livelihood or social reprobation are all kinds of facets of oppression and so on. So a person should be allowed to use their conscience in the matter. Now, you could argue, now, the counter-argument is, if an institution is, let's say, state-based institution, it should be neutral, and so there is should be some kind of form of compulsion in this matter. You shouldn't discriminate. Well, firstly, the state it represents the people, and that person who was fired from their job is one of the people and pays taxes and deserves the right of representation. I don't want to quote Thomas Jefferson, but he says words to the effect of that to compel anyone to pay money and not represent their opinions in government is basically a sinful and tyrannical system. Basically, so if a person working in the NHS refuses to perform some kind of a procedure on, let's say, for example, on a transsexual, thinking that's against their conscience, or they refuse to join the army and go to war in Iraq because their conscience is objective, which I think there is some kind of remit for that, although I think there's only if you're against war, not rather against a particular war. You should be given the right to act according to your conscience. There is no mandatory compulsion in any of these matters. And I think in the old form of liberalism or libertarianism, it was all about just permitted actions. People were permitted their actions and so on. But in this kind of new social liberalism or libertarianism 2.0, whatever you want to call it, it's become permitted actions and now become compelled entitlements, where now you are compelled to act against your conscience, otherwise you are viewed as discriminating. And identity group politics is not even based on the individual, it's based on the group. So you're even going against the base of liberalism in the first place, which is where it's so confusing and contradictory. So I think a major kind of check of the foundations, a recheck of these foundations, I think is ordered, because I think a lot of people are being denied the right to follow their conscience, I feel.
I think you're being a bit harsh on Western society.
I thought I was being gentle.
Oh dear.
Do you have any final inputs at all?
Final inputs? Oh, okay. caveat. I want to caveat that, right? I've been kind of a bit of a sourpuss. But there are some great aspects about Western society, which I think is great, very great, because it matches very much the Islamic conception. So the right to debate in Islam, anything's up for debate. The first debate between Muslims and Christians was held by the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam in his own mosque, and they rejected he was a prophet to his face. And after that, they were allowed to even pray in that mosque. So Christians were allowed to do Christian prayers in the mosque, because obviously it was late and they maybe wanted to do prayers before going home. And that was that, and that, I see that spirit of debate, in the West, to some degree. And I think that's excellent. I think there's some great concepts. All these liberal philosophers I quoted, they had a great desire to see people not be oppressed, to see people not be miserable, and so on, not suffer. I'm not condemning them. I don't think they're evil or spawn of Satan. I don't, none of that. I think they actually desired good. I really think they desired good. But as I said, just because people desire good doesn't necessarily mean that what you come out with might be a good thing, or might not be malformed or any of these things. So I say there's a lot of great things in the West, which I think that Islam in the West has a lot of commonalities. But I'm just trying to highlight, because obviously this debate is about human rights and obviously the clashes, where these clashes are, why these clashes are, and maybe to try to get rid of some myths about liberalism itself, so we can take a good, naked truth on liberalism, what it is, and maybe what we should criticize about it, or scrutinize about it, or rethink, or recheck, and so on. I think that's always good and healthy to do that. So that's all I've been trying to do today. I haven't just been Mr. Contrary, so...
Could I just say one thing very quickly? There was an article in the Badger which I feel I have to comment on. If you're giving us each a last chance, it was an article about the Jewish student who felt that his human rights were violated by the fact that he was forced to take an exam on the Sabbath, and the equality, the appropriate department, the progress and what's the department called? I'm not even a student here. So.
Student progress and development.
Progress and assessment.
The student progress and assessment office weren't accommodating him properly, and he got quite the article. I don't know if anyone here has read the article. You're law students, you don't read the Badger. But he came across as the article came across as sounding like the university were extremely unaccommodating, and I want to reject that. The university have a very clear outlined criteria for how a Jewish student who observes the Sabbath should approach the university with clear dates. At the end of the autumn term, you have to notify them to give them the time that they need to be able to accommodate you, and those rights and the policy guidelines relating to those rights are very, very clear. The students seem to ignore those rights and then made a fuss. So I think it's essential when we talk about human rights that we take our responsibility of looking at all of the details properly and not making a fuss about things that are not fussed about. I hear often from Jewish students saying it's not fair that the Freshers' Fair fell out on Yom Kippur. So it's not fair that Yom Kippur fell out on Freshers' Fair. If you want to live in a Western society, nobody's telling us to go away. Nobody's undermining our rights. They happen to have a Freshers' Fair. If you want to, you want all the freebies in Freshers' Fair, email all of the societies that you want their freebies from and say, unfortunately, it's Yom Kippur, I can't attend. I'm not asking you to change the date of Freshers' Fair, but please give me a doggy bag. I'm quite happy with this.
Yeah, I think I'd just conclude by pointing out that I guess what the discussion has revealed, and you probably knew already, it's that these issues are not clear-cut, certainly from a human rights perspective. There is no, this is obviously a human rights violation. This is how the European Court of Human Rights, for example, would decide such a case. And what I would say is just point out that it's not all about the European Court of Human Rights. The UN Human Rights Committee, which monitors the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which also has a right to freedom of religion, actually in quite a few recent cases on freedom of religion, has adopted a very different position to the European Court of Human Rights in determining what is necessary in a democratic society and what is proportional. There are a few cases involving Sikh, the wearing of religious clothing, and cases brought by Sikh applicants where the Human Rights Committee very clearly diverged from the jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights. And there are lots of interesting cases coming up. Pay attention.
That's quite interesting.
I guess liberalism has actually taken quite a bashing tonight. I think it's been quite misunderstood in the way it's saying. The idea really behind it is that you're trying to balance lots of people's interests within a fair society. It's not taking one over the other. It's trying to maintain everybody's rights. There are going to be points in which those clash, and that's obviously the point of the legal system, and that judges have that option to interpret the law to mediate that. They're not always going to get it right. I was going to say something else as well. The idea, especially particularly obviously this is relating to human rights and religion. Obviously the right to a religious is having a religion, holding a belief, whatever that may be, is protected, but that really should be not at the expense of other people's rights not to be discriminated against or not to have any actions performed against their person.
I'd like to thank all the speakers for coming along today. It was very, very very revealing, and I certainly learned a lot as well, a lot of current issues that I'm now going to read up on because I feel like an ignoramus. Just for taking the trip down here as well, thank you very much, Abdullah. Thank you for coming along at the last moment, Rabbi.
The last moment because you kept pushing it up.
I kept pushing it back, yeah. And thank you very much, Dr. Craig, for kindly responding to my emails and being genuinely interested. And thank you, Shane, for introducing a new perspective on it as well. And I'd like to thank everybody who's posed a question to the panel and everyone who came along and sat for an extra 40 minutes.
We started 10 minutes later.
That's true, yeah. Hour and a half. Thank you very much.